This is Monitor Al Capstaff steering the proceedings at the moment on this New Year's Day, 1956. Right now, we're headed in the direction of the University of Chicago. For New World Today, our host on these weekly discussions has invited some experts on American manners and morals to join him. For at the beginning of the new year, what is more appropriate than to examine some of the changes that have come over American life in the years that have recently flown by? For the story, Monitor goes to Chicago and Professor Edward W. Rosenheim, Jr.
Today, Professor Walter Johnson, chairman of the University of Chicago's History Department, and I are playing host to a very welcome visitor. He's a distinguished Ph.D. in political science from this university, and you'll find his name, Leo Rosten, listed as the special editorial advisor to Look magazine. His books and articles under this name are numerous. He's taught political science in the graduate school at Yale. But perhaps our listeners will respond most enthusiastically to the fact that Mr. Rosten is also Leonard Q. Ross, author of that superb treatise on linguistics, sociology, and psychology, The Education of Hyman Kaplan. And I can't help adding in introducing you, Mr. Rosten, that at lunch today, Quincy Wright, a professor in the Department of Political Science, told me a story to the effect that the day after your final doctor's orals, he went over to the University of Chicago bookstore and found an enormous stack of copies of your dissertation selling like hot cakes. It seems to me in this whole catalog of distinction, this is perhaps the most impressive story of all.
Well, it happens to be true.
It's actually true. I suppose you were sort of on the hook at that moment, because if you hadn't passed the orals, would sales have been affected?
Well, it never occurred to me that I wouldn't pass.
Fine. That shows the proper spirit.
I knew everyone on the committee.
This is a special insight into the operation of academic machinery. Well, we thought today we'd talk a little bit about a topic which might be described in any one of a number of ways, but the real question I suppose we're asking is, is America really changing, or has America really changed? And I imagine we can begin by throwing the ball to you, Mr. Rosten. As your repertorial and scholarly eye looks about the superficial manners and customs of our fellow Americans, do you think there have been changes?
Oh, yes. I'm struck by, well, to start with very simple things, the way in which our thinking and our language has changed in interpreting the behavior of each other. That is, about 30 years ago, if someone left a dinner party, everyone would think it was something he ate. Today, everyone says, I wonder what's eating him. 30 years ago, people were crazy. Now they're neurotic. 30 or 40 years ago, a person could be called a Don Juan. Now he's called compulsive or an exhibitionist. 30 years ago, you'd say of a person that he had certain personality quirks. Now they're symptoms. And though this may seem to be superficial, I think it points to the fact that our whole life has become shot through with an awareness of two things: emotions as important factors in the behavior of people, whether in ordinary social affairs or political or economic affairs, and secondly, the very high and relevant role of what you might call psychiatry. These things are reflected in our literature, in our morals, our manners, and even in our children, who have become insightful.
On the whole, are you alarmed by this tendency? You've really implied that we've learned more and learned to look for more in this description of a changing vocabulary. What do you think, Mr. Johnson? Do you view with alarm this rather dramatic alteration that Mr. Rosten's pointed to?
Well, Mr. Rosenheim, when you look at this question, we Americans have been trying to describe ourselves for 300 years. There have been book after book on this subject. We had de Tocqueville 100 years ago, Bryce 80 years ago, good descriptions of America. But I think Rosten's quite right. If you look at the books today, in the last 10 years that describe America, there's new language, there's new jargon, describing things that we've known about ourselves for a long time. And one of the great difficulties I face in trying to read these new books is style has gone out of the books.
Yes.
People simply don't care about good writing, apparently,
anymore.
I suppose one thing that contributes to that is the phenomenon of communication. When somebody does strike on a phrase, an apt phrase, it rapidly becomes a cliche because everybody uses it, and there isn't quite as much premium on originality in literary style.
And partly, I think, everyone in America wants to be an expert. There's a premium on being well-informed. And well-informed means informed about the latest and the most current thing. I don't think this is so true, say, in England or France as it is here. But apart from the change in language, I am struck by the fact that there is a great attempt to understand people and their behavior. There is an attempt to get insight. What I resent is the ease with which people think that by using certain words, they're saying anything really meaningful. For instance, the word sick. People are permitted all sorts of outrageous and, let us say, irresponsible conduct, and other people simply say, well, you've got to understand, he's sick. Now, there was a time when sick meant physiologically imbalanced. Now it means anything which departs from our idea of what a responsible person ought to be doing. And so we say, he's sick. This, I think, is unfortunate.
Well, of course, there is a school of thought that says that that reflects the state of affairs that should be. They point, for example, to Samuel Butler's Erewhon, written in the last century, say that, remind us that Butler felt that in the ideal society, people who were antisocial should be treated as invalids, but that there was really no excuse for disease. Do you think this paints too extreme a picture of it?
Well, I think we take it too easily. I think we have, in a sense, sacrificed one of the great enduring values of the United States, and certainly one that it seems to me is worth preserving, that is the idea of character. We don't as much demand of people performance and discipline.
Oh, yeah,
the sense of character.
The new word, Roston, is you've got to be acceptable to the group. Isn't that your key phrase today, frequently? Instead of a man being an individualist and standing for self-discipline, self-responsibility, the language, the books seem to tell me that the important thing is, are you accepted by the group?
It isn't any longer to thine own self be true, but to thine own social stratum.
Sure, that is correct. Sure, sure.
Well, do you think the consequences of this change in vocabulary, this change in habit, really are very far-reaching? Do you think they strike pretty deep into the nature of American character, or are these just surface symptoms, to use the word you objected to?
I think they are deep. For example, the relationship between parents and children, I think, has become one that we ought to be concerned about. The increased anxiety of parents about their responsibility, so that they feel they must be amateur child psychologists, amateur psychiatrists, amateur marriage counselors in situations when, before, one would react according to the values that we had accepted and known as good values, as representing that which a good parent honorably or honestly does, without trying to take over the role of the abnormal or the expert, the psychiatrist.
Well, it seems to me that we've reached the position of saying that if a problem exists, there must be a solution for it, and we try all to become experts in a whole area of problems that we simply can't be experts. We haven't realized that a lot of problems are never going to be solved.
Do you think Americans can ever believe that there's a problem that can't be solved, Mr. Johnson?
Well, perhaps not, but there's lots of problems, for instance, in Asia, that we may think we can solve with technical aid and with money, we're not going to solve. We better learn it before it's too late.
Do you think we're raised on the assumption that all problems are soluble?
Oh, I think very definitely, and particularly in the last 30 years. Two great world wars and a depression. Out of the depression came a very enduring heritage here, and that's the idea that people planning together in government or in business can solve problems.
Well, in other words, we're not merely being fatuous in saying that all problems can be solved. There's a good deal of evidence over the last 30 years that we've solved things that were previously considered insoluble.
I think quite remarkable. I remember at the university here in 1932, a group of us were sitting around a table about a week before Franklin Roosevelt was sworn in as president. And as we confronted the problems that America faced then, I doubt whether any one of us would have dared to predict the immensity of the changes that have since taken place without violence. The immensity of the changes in the political structure, the power structure, the economic structure of this country. For example, the business of solving problems, the assumption that things can be changed, that we can change things, in Mr. Johnson's words, working together we can, has led to a whole new way of looking at things like old age or unemployment or depression or inflation. There was a time when these were considered inevitable, almost as if the fates had demanded that man suffer. Today we say no. What can we do about? It can be housing, it can be flood control, it can be medicine, anything. What can we do about it? And this, I think, is good.
As a matter of fact, I think it's rather characteristic of our time that we do think in terms of problems, I suppose outside of a few prepositions and articles, the word problem has been used in these microphones here at the Mitchell Tower more frequently than any other single noun, certainly. We are becoming perhaps a nation of problem solvers, but I also think we're a nation of problem seekers. I sometimes worry that we talk about the problem of this or that a little too easily. The problem of leisure time, for instance, is one that always strikes me as rather amusing. I don't think it ever existed before, did it?
That's so far as I know.
Well, we overorganize things, don't we, today in America? Isn't this one of the problems?
We overorganize. You mean you're raising another problem?
I'm raising another problem. But to be optimistic about us in terms of have we changed, can we change, are we changing, I'd like to pick up your point, Mr. Austin, about the changes that came in the 1930s in the power structure in America. Really a bloodless revolution in one sense. And that is, we adjusted in the last 20-odd years to the problem of democracy and capitalism working together for the mass of people. I think this is a fundamental and a very powerful development. So today, we don't really have the phrase creeping socialism in America. We have galloping capitalism. A capitalism that's adjusted to democratic ends to a great extent. Oh, there may be weaknesses here and there, but not in the total. Then another optimistic development seems to be in America has been the way most people have adjusted to world leadership. We have accepted since 1945 tremendous new responsibilities.
Yes.
I think we're doing pretty well on these, on the whole.
As a minor footnote on that, let me be the devil's advocate for a moment. I'm a little concerned that there isn't an articulate isolationist movement. Now, let me hasten to say this is not because I'm an isolationist. I'm not. But I wish that we had, more actively, more healthily, a real examination of the choices we have and the prices we pay for the kind of world leadership we have assumed, and the alternatives to it, which no longer are being seriously considered.
Well, that's fair enough. What we have is a very peculiar form of isolationism. A group who want to be isolated from Europe, but want to intervene in the Far East to take action against the communists in China, for instance. This only involves us more in the world. It isn't isolationism, as you're talking about.
Yes. This is odd to me because in the age of atomic power and aircraft, you know, it might be easier to take an isolationist position than ever before. Before, with land armies and with naval power what it was a little easier for people to say, we are safer behind our own frontiers, let the enemy come to us, there's no point in going to meet him. Today we might well say, well, it doesn't make much difference whether we're on the Rhine or in France or in Italy. That air power is such that perhaps our best security interest lies in staying here and not expending our wealth or our energy or our arms all throughout the world.
Well, how do you account for the disappearance of this attitude? Because
well,
I think that's
may
what
I suggest it comes back perhaps to words that Mr. Austin was mentioning at the beginning. Perhaps the word isolation or isolationism isn't respectable anymore.
No, it isn't.
And respectability is an important aspect of our society, isn't it? Just as conformity is?
I think what we do now is talk more about air strategy. But all of this raises another point, Mr. Johnson. I think that the United States today asks more of the human being than any country ever asked of the individual before.
Oh, yes, I agree with that. It seems to me that we ask and raise problems for the average citizen that are too complex to be solved. That everybody cannot be an expert in foreign policy, on conservation, on education, on social security. And yet we treat them as though they should be experts in all these problems.
Well, that would mean then that leadership becomes more important than ever.
Quite. And a respect for your leadership.
Or a respect for expert specialists, actually.
Well, we have the respect for experts, sometimes I think maybe too much. In addition to what we ask of people as experts in politics, think of what we ask of them in terms of their ordinary, everyday conduct. We expect them to handle their aggressions, their hostilities, their unconscious, irrational drives. Why? Because every bookstore has books which will explain to everybody what really makes him tick, what really makes his child tick, what he can do to make everybody happier. And this has placed demands on us, I think, that are a little excessive, because here I would agree with Mr. Johnson most strongly that it may well be that in the human drama and the human tragedy, a very large area of those things which give us pain and conflict may never be soluble. It may be part of the human adventure, if you want to call it that, or part of what the Greeks were talking about when they talked about the fates.
Well, we're back again, it seems to me, on what might be called our way of life here in America. And you just painted it as a remarkably complex and demanding way of life. I think this is probably true. On the other hand, it's almost a platitude to say that we enjoy all the fruits of modern technology, that we're emancipated, that we have freedom. They particularly point to the area of women's activities as a triumphant example of this sort of thing. What would you say about that, Mr. Roskin?
Well, on the role of women, I'm afraid I take an extremely unpopular view. I think that in the last 20 years, we have done great damage to women in confusing them about the role they ought to play. Put it this way, our grandmothers, or our mothers for that example, knew that if they were good mothers and raised their families and were responsible people and good wives, they had done a fairly noble and honorable thing. I think in the last 20 years, partly as a result of popular education, partly as a result of the popularization of psychiatry, we have given women the idea that there's something wrong in being just a wife, or just a mother, or just a woman. And coupled with the pressures of advertising and of the popular media, we have demanded of women that they become intellectuals, that they become sportsmen, that they become pals to their husbands, psychiatrists to their children, League of Women Voters experts on tariffs and foreign aid. Even in running their household now, they've got to know about something called household economics instead of just sensible planning. And I think that women have become pulled in so many directions that their own identity has become obscured. For my part, I think it would be better if we had a clearer and simpler image of the role of the woman in society.
Of course, on the other hand, there are those who would insist that despite the complexity of these demands made upon women, women are rising to the demand in a rather gallant and successful way, that women are actually playing a tremendously important part in our national life, in our economic life, and in all of these new areas that they've recently invaded.
Have you talked to any of your English friends recently about the role of women in America or the role of the man in the household? He wouldn't agree with you.
What would he say, Mr. Johnson?
Well, I think my English friends tell me they think that the American male is so completely dominated now by this new woman you're talking about, Mr. Austin, that the home and existence ceases to be important.
Certainly, in England, one is struck by the fact that there has been preserved a much more clear and perhaps simpler image of the woman who is respected in a way more than she is in the United States. Much more.
On the other hand, of course, there are many British women who occupy positions of leadership.
Yes.
The political life of the country, some of the great scholars, some of the great creative writers and thinkers in England are certainly women. Presumably, the resources of that sort wouldn't be available if women were not encouraged to take an active part in the affairs of life.
Well, I'm not saying that women should not be encouraged. I'm saying that the values, the education, if you want, the ideas that we give to people about themselves and what they ought to be has become a little askew. That many women who by no stretch of the imagination should want to be intellectuals are guilty if they don't try to be intellectuals. Now, we don't ask this of men, oddly enough. A man can achieve honor in his community if he works 8 hours a day, comes home tired, has a drink, looks at television, and goes to bed. He's done an honorable day's work. But the woman who, quote, only takes care of the home and the children is on the defensive. She's got to do something else.
Well, I suppose as far as our discussion is concerned, we were wise in asking the question, has America changed? Because I suppose Mr. Johnson and I would both agree with you, Mr. Roskin, that with respect to woman's status, America has changed. We'd, I suppose, differ in whether the change is a good one or a bad one. Perhaps we might, as our time draws to a close, get a little more serious for a moment and raise this question. On the whole, do you think in a very fundamental way that the character of Americans has changed?
I think for the better, in the sense that we have come to realize that there are certain problems, use that word again, or certain responsibilities that we cannot evade. That, for example, in the field of human rights or in the field of civil liberties, more and more people have become aware that there is no ducking the problems raised in politics or in economics or in the community itself, that you pay a terrible price for remaining, quote, out of things. Who was it who said that the only thing that evil needs to prevail is for the good to do nothing? I think more and more people have become impressed with the fact that they cannot stand on the sidelines. And one of the prices we're paying for this may appear to be confusion, uncertainty, wrangling, but at least it means participation, which I think is all to the good.
Yes, I'm optimistic too, Mr. Eisenheim, on this point, because I think the mass of the public have definitely accepted responsibility in the area of bringing about a better distribution of wealth in the United States, that they as businessmen or just as citizens or as people in government have to work on this. And also, they've accepted world leadership to a surprising degree in just 10 years.
Yes.
This is tremendously encouraging.
And from the standpoint of the American historian, you feel that this represents a genuine and fundamental change.
Well, I think what it means is that the citizen has adjusted to the new position the United States has. We've been building toward that new position for 250 years. Okay. Suddenly we're in it overnight, and we've come along pretty well in recognizing it.
Thanks very much, gentlemen, and in particular, thank you, Leo Rosten, for joining us on this broadcast on Changing America and helping us to ring out the old and ring in the new. We've heard today from Leo Rosten, political scientist, writer, editor, and Walter Johnson, chairman of the University of Chicago's Department of History. This is Edward Rosenheim at the University of Chicago, returning you with the happiest of New Year wishes to Radio Central, New York.
And that was New World for Today, a discussion of changes in America. Next week, some wisdom on the art of translation. About a minute and a half before the hour, and this is Monitor with Al Capstaff, just about ready to drive back for a bit of our family's New Year's festivities in Darien, Connecticut.